I call the meeting to order. The Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division. I want to thank those members who could come today. I know we've got campaigns going on and there's folks who couldn't come, but I thank you very much for coming, and I think the participants will be here. We call this meeting because there's a lot of questions out there about what's going on with the federal provisions and actually both the Housing and Economic Recovery Act, whose money I believe is going to start flowing here shortly, but also the Rescue Act, the Bailout Act, the Economic Emergency Stabilization Act, whatever you call the second one that just got passed here a couple days ago. And how does that relate to housing and the kind of crisis that we're having in foreclosure and affordability and so on? So we're going to just try to get some information out there on the table today. I know, at least I find my constituents are asking me, what does this mean for me? Is there help? Is there anything I can do to access some of these funds? So today is basically an informational session, and I think we've got some really good folks here who are going to help us understand what's going on. We're going to start right away with some background and overview, and I'd like to, that'll be on the Federal Housing and Economic Recovery Act, and I'd like to ask, I believe, Sue Paulbeck and Linda Harris from the Minnesota Housing Action Coalition are going to start first, and you can introduce yourselves and say anything more you'd like about that.
Sure. Thank you, Representative and Chairman Clark. Chip Paulbach, I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership, and in this background presentation, I'm going to provide some of the information that came out in the ACS American Community Survey census data that was just released in September to provide more of a context for the discussion about foreclosure. Joining me will be Melissa Manderscheid from the Foreclosure Council Partnership, who will get into some of the numbers about foreclosures and housing vacancies across the state. And then Linda Harris from HomeLine and the Federal Housing Action Coalition will give a brief outline of the Housing and Economic Recovery Act and some of the other federal housing legislation just passed. So now, as I said, in September 23rd, the Census Bureau released the latest round of housing data, and what it showed was that in Minnesota, that a little over 2 million households are in the state. The home ownership rate in Minnesota was 75%. That was declined very slightly from 2006 and still keeps us number one in the country, as Minnesota for a number of years has been high, very high, one, two, or three in home ownership. But of course, the foreclosure crisis we're going to speak about is really part of a broader economic crisis facing the state and the country. And I'm going to hone in on some of the numbers about numbers of households across the state that are cost burdened with their households, both renters and homeowners, and severely cost burdened. So for cost burden, HUD has defined that as paying 30% or more of income for households, income for housing. Now, that encompasses a lot of people in this state. So nearly one in three households in Minnesota are cost burdened as of the 2007 ACS data. So what does that mean? A quick illustration on what being cost burdened means. Taking households that are earning $20,000, $40,000, and $60,000. So for a $20,000 annual income household, 30% is $6,000 per year or $500 per month. So under that standard, that's what a household should be able to pay for housing. For $40,000, it's $1,000 a month, and for $60,000, $1,500 per month. But you have to look at what is you're paying for household housing in light of other cost of living expenses. And there we rely on information compiled by the Jobs Now Coalition, which looks at what a household of four, two adults, two children, typically pay in Minnesota. So you go from transportation down to housing. And that adds up to over $4,000 a month or $50,000 per year. So looking at those as typical expenses that a household would pay, if you're a family of four earning less than $50,000 per year, you're probably cutting somewhere in that. Of that $50,000 or $4,000 a month, $3,200 are non-housing expenses. So we'll use that as a basis to look at what this 30% for housing means. So if you look at the $3,200 per month in this slide across these income ranges, and you see for a $20,000 household that the monthly income is a little over $1,600. Well, you can't make any cover any of your typical expenses there. And so a household who has that level of income really is reliant on many public supports, from food stamps to other types of support for child care and that. But when you go up to $40,000 annual income, which is $3,300 a month, that's where I think we want to really consider what's happening to hundreds of thousands of households across the state that are in that condition. So if you make $40,000 per year, your monthly income is $3,300, and the non-housing expenses here are almost that full amount, $3,276. So even though under the 30% for housing standard, that household should be able to find housing for $1,000 a month, you can see when you add up all of those expenses, you're not cutting it. You have to make significant cuts in your budget somewhere along that line. At $60,000 per year or $5,000 per month, then you can make that 30% of your income for housing standard. There you can just cover $1,500 a month. Of course, many families making $60,000 a year rely on two incomes, and there if you have one of the adults in the family lose their job, or if there's a health care crisis or something of that nature, then they flip and become in that position of not being able to meet the basic expenses. So taking that, now going back to some of the information from the 2007 ACF data, the census data. So there, one of the things I want to point out is almost half of the renter households across the state are cost burdens. For owners, the big story is how that has changed over time. Whereas in 2002, 1 in 18 ownership families were cost burdened. By 2007, that's increased to 1 in 9. And then for the bottom 2 points, if you look at households with incomes over below $50,000 annual income, half of the renters and half of the owners are cost burdened, whereas above that amount, that percentage declined significantly.
I have a question. When you're talking about housing, does that include the cost of utilities, or is that a separate?
When I talk about housing using the census data, that does include heat and electricity. So, yes, utilities, basic utilities.
And is that utilities at today's rate, or?
Well, this is utilities at 2007 rate, and I have some information about how the costs are increasing.
Thank you.
Manager. So where does Minnesota fit in all of this? So here we have a state with 1 in 3 households cost burden, but still Minnesota, relative to a lot of other states, is still in a good position. in that we're about in the middle of the pack, and you can see what the numbers are comparing renters and ownership. Now, turning from cost burden to severe cost burden. Severe cost burden are households that are paying over half of their income for housing. And those are the families that really cycle in and out of homelessness and are basically teetering on the brink of financial disaster. And there we have, from in 2007, 253,000 households across the state, or one in eight households at that time, renter and owner, was paying half of their income or more for housing. Here, this slide basically shows how that's changing over time. And you can see that for homeowners in the red bars, how that has significantly increased starting in 2004. And that's very much aligned with what was how house prices took off at that time, and also all of these crazy mortgage products. And a lot of people were buying homes that got them into trouble over time. And this is just one slide that represents how that looks in terms of households. Now again, this is paying over half of their income for housing. So in either case, renters or ownership, by 2007, it's over 100,000. And just this only runs to 2006, but it's to show how Minnesota has changed more rapidly than other states. In fact, the transition between here 2000 and 2006 in terms of numbers of households in Minnesota paying over half their income for housing increased faster here than any other state in the country. And I think that had to do with flat or declining income while during that period, the first half of this decade, housing costs continued to increase. And you might ask, well, as we look at 2007, you know, aren't we seeing a change because housing prices are going down significantly in the last year? But as this slide points out, that affects a small minority of households, people that are just now buying homes. But the vast majority of people who are in home ownership are not seeing their costs decline. Now back to renters. So just to give you of the renters in Minnesota, who is extremely cost burden? Who's paying over half their income for housing? Well, if you look at extremely low income renters, that is really where the problem is manifest the most. So people, that's say the average household income of about $20,000 per year. Well over half of households in Minnesota that are in that position are paying over half their income for housing, and then declines significantly as your income goes up in terms of being a position as a renter paying over half your income for housing. This is more recent data relying on some of the polling in the metro area, the survey in the metro area of what's going on. And these last slides are just to show how the problem we have that was illustrated through the census data in 2007 is going to become even a little more significant for the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who are already cost burden. With rent, you see a spiking upward of rent recently, and that has to do with a sort of a flat production of rental housing, as well as a loss of some of the lower cost rental housing that we'll see. And in general, as more and more people are out of the home buying market and are requiring to rent. So you're seeing the vacancy rates go down and rents go up. And here, Chairman Clark, to your question, Again, looking ahead of people who are already cost burdened, and we show that if you're $20,000 per year or $40,000 per year, you are having to make trade-offs, significant trade-offs in your life in terms of what cost you can cover and what you can't cover. And just to show that, 2007 to 2008, looking at wages, you have some significant living costs, groceries, gasoline, household fuels, going up much faster than wages. So getting back to the Jobs Now data, which shows that even excluding housing costs, a number of households are having a tough time making those other expenses in life. If they did that survey again in 2008, it would even be tougher. That monthly costs for the basics of living are going up much faster than people's income. And on the fuels, again, you know, this is something that's difficult to track because fuel costs go up and down fairly rapidly, but you see the trends there, again, going up much faster than income. So how does this manifest? I mentioned the loss of lower cost apartments. In Minnesota, in terms of what can a median income renter afford, in 2000 that was $650 a month, 2007 $700 a month. If you look at what's happened to the rental supply, is between those two periods, this a little over first half of the decade, the state has lost in 53,000 apartments that are affordable to renters that are at that median median rental income in terms of what they could afford. That's 18% of the more affordable apartments have been lost in this little over first half of the decade. So again, that reinforces why rents are going up and the vacancy rate is going down. At the same time that we're losing those apartments, numbers of renters are increasing. So how is all of this manifest?
Yes. Just have an excellent extra question. Would you just say a little bit more about what that means that they're lost? Are they eliminated? Have they become more expensive? Are they converted to condos? What are we talking about?
It's a variety of things. And the census data just shows you how many apartments are renting at that level. So it doesn't give any explanation of why. But we know that that with the tightening rental market, rents are going up, and so would go beyond that amount. We also know a lot of rental apartments have been just lost. I mean, these are the inexpensive rental apartments. A lot of them are not in very good condition. Many get torn down and/or converted to other use. But the census data just provides the gross number of rents that are available at that amount. And so, you know, what's happening because of all of these things going on with housing costs going up, other costs of living going up, while incomes are flat or declining. So we're seeing, of course, many people hoping to get Section 8 certificates, a resource that has only expanded minimally over the last decade. And so these are just numbers. The first one, Minneapolis, 14,000 people applied in Minneapolis for a Section 8 certificate for a public housing agency that only is able to make available about 30 new vouchers per month in other communities. And we don't have one for greater Minnesota, but it's a significant problem there too. And in addition to people lined up or hoping to get some help with the rent, we then have, an increase in homelessness. And homelessness in Minnesota had been declining for a number of years, in part because of the good work going on by the State Housing Agency, in part because people that for a while incomes were increasing. But as you see here, 2007 and through partial 2008, we have a real spike in homelessness in Minnesota. And then also what has been in the news recently is a particularly troublesome component of that, and that is many, many more children are homeless in this state. And as is shown here, over 6% in Minneapolis schools are homeless at some point in the year. In Minneapolis as a whole, some over 5,000 homeless children and youth, up 19%. So these, in terms of seeing people hoping to get rent assistance and these long lines for very few additional resources, and also the spike in homelessness are manifestations of this flat declining income, rapidly increasing housing costs, and other costs of living that are outpacing people's income. So these are just part of the overall economic picture that's impacting what people can afford for housing, what they're paying for housing, as we spend some more time honing in on the foreclosure crisis.
Mr. Halbert, any immediate questions from committee members? We can hear from my second witness and then give us more questions. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure.
And
I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself, please? Good morning. My name is Melissa Manderside, and I'm an attorney on behalf of Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council. And I kept asking to speak about foreclosure data real briefly. So I thought it would be helpful to answer a couple of the questions that seem to come up in my mind and in others when we talk about foreclosures. So basically, first question is, where are we at? Is it getting better or is it getting worse? I thought this slide was helpful in that it explained where we are, both as a state, but then also too in Greater Minnesota as opposed to the Twin Cities. Included in that blue box are some projections that have been put together by HousingLink. They're revised, and the initial report was issued back in April, and they've had to revise their numbers up for 2008 projections for foreclosures. Also, who has been affected? Clearly, many people are touched by foreclosure. These particular calculations are based on a HousingLink report as well as some research that's been done by the Federal Reserve. Another question that often comes up is, it just a metro problem? Here's a map that shows the concentration of REO, real estate owned properties. These are properties that are owned by the banks as compared to foreclosures. So this is sort of the backside of foreclosures, and you can see in our state we actually have more properties that are owned by banks after the foreclosure as compared to actual foreclosures. Another question, where are these? The first slide I had touched on this, but again, here is a depiction that shows the location of these subprime loans that are in foreclosure. The darker the color, the higher the concentration of foreclosures. And now these particular foreclosures that are depicted on this map are subprime loans that have been securitized, which is the majority of the subprime loans. And then the big question here, is it getting any better? Based on some data that has been purchased and has been used nationwide by the Federal Reserve, I think the bad news is no, it's not going to get any better. Based on these numbers here, the past due of subprime and Alt-A loans, which are the high-risk loans, 12,000. We know that a certain percentage of those are going to go into foreclosure. ARMs, we all have been hearing a lot about those. Over 45,000 ARMs are still in our state. And then there are 20,000 that have yet to reset. And so we know that when arms reset, there is a connection between foreclosure and the resetting. So definitely some scary statistics. And the last one here, over 17,000 loans that were interest only. So when that interest only period ends and they go into a more principal and interest type of payment, there's a heightened likelihood that they're going to foreclosure. Here's another way of describing it. This has to do with, this particular chart shows arms and the reset schedules. So the first bar is the ones that have reset already. The second bar are those that are predicted to reset in the next 12 months and then going out there. So as you see, we've got more than just a few months left of this foreclosure crisis. And based on this chart here, 24 plus months out, so two more years, we're looking at substantially more resets of adjustable rate mortgages. And lastly, that's just a brief overview of the foreclosure data.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. If I'm adding up these numbers right, we got about 95,000 more houses that are past due and about to be reset or deal with the foreclosure issue. Is that right?
Are you talking...
I was looking at, is it getting any better? And the answer is no. And then there's 12,000 subprime ones, there's 45,000 of owner-occupied arms, there's 20,000 more that are yet to reset, and 17,000 interest only. And those are ones that are all at risk from what you're saying, right?
Correct.
That's about 95,000, I believe?
Correct. Housing Link has done some projections for 2008 through the end of this year, and they predict that for 2008, we're going to have over 29,000 foreclosures. Some of those have already occurred, obviously, but through the year end, we'll have almost 30,000 statewide.
Is that total or yet to come?
Total.
Okay.
And if you compare that to the number of foreclosures that occurred from 2005 to 2007, it's only about 8,000 less over a several-year period as compared to just 2008.
Okay, so it's escalating.
Correct.
Do you have an idea of when those reset dates are?
Madam Chair, this slide here provides a bit more information about when this when these loans will be resetting. This First American Loan Performance data set, it tracks loans that have been securitized, so it doesn't capture the entire market of loans that are out there. It only captures a subset of them, but it does capture the most likely to be foreclosed loans.
Senator Vanderveer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let me welcome you. I just want to tell you, we did invite, you're representing the Senate.
Apparently.
The Republican section. But we did invite several Senate committees, Health and Housing, Economic Development, and also Senate Lewis Committee, as well as a number of our House committees. So,
and thank you.
Don't feel too burdened with the responsibility, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These loans that are adjusting, is the decline in short-term interest rates, which over the last probably year or so, is that likely to make these, reduce the interest rates these people are paying, or are these all subprime that are tied into some different index?
The loans that are represented on this particular chart are all loans that were when they were originated were subprime, either Alt A, so they had an element of them that were subprime, but otherwise were prime, near prime loans, or they were Alt A, or they were subprime loans. There aren't any prime loans that are in this data set.
So, Madam Chair, these loans aren't likely to. The interest rate isn't likely to go down when they adjust?
The loans in this particular pool, if they're interest only, when that period, as an example, when that period of interest only ends, they're going to see a dramatic spike in their monthly payment due to the fact that principal is now now a part of their monthly payment. So in that way, it's not necessarily as tied to the interest rate.
Thank you.
Okay. You probably don't have numbers for this, but how much is the effect, you know, of people who simply lose their job and can't carry their mortgage, which is a normal mortgage?
This has been a common cause of foreclosure for all kinds. Medical bills, divorce, death, those types of causes of foreclosure were present in the past and continue to be a part of the causes of foreclosure now. However, the big increase in our situation now, in the foreclosure situation now, is directly attributable, most people say, to the presence of these exotic mortgages.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. For those of us that have never been through an ARM readjustment, what does that mean to the homeowner? Do they get a notice? Can you just maybe quickly walk through what that process looks like? How long do they have? And then is their income reassessed when those ARMs are reset?
Okay. Representative, you know, I don't actually know what the paperwork is, if their income is reevaluated. I know that they oftentimes will get a letter and that, you know, that their new payment amount is this, and there are communications related to that, but I don't believe that there's a reevaluation of their income. But I can check on that for you.
Right. Madam Chair, will there be anybody that might be able to answer that question? I'd like to understand the process.
We're going to have any campaign if you're
okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Chair, for you next.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Linda Harris, and I'm the chairperson of the Minnesota Federal Housing Action Board. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the federal legislation that is wrapping up this year and what our housing needs will be looking forward to in 2009. It is important to understand that I will be covering only a microcosm of all of the housing legislation, and I'm sure that most of my colleagues here will be discussing more in detail as to what's going on at the Minnesota state level. There are two key legislative actions that I would like to discuss with you today. These include the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008 and the HUD federal budget.
Can you speak up just a little bit? It's hard to hear you.
Is that better?
I think
it's better. No?
Yeah.
Okay. The Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008 was signed into law on July 30th of 2008. There are several key provisions that you should be aware of. The first is the increase in funding for affordable rental housing. The Neighborhood Stabilization Fund grants $3.92 billion to states and localities to redevelop foreclosed properties. Funds must be used to purchase, manage, and resell foreclosed and abandoned properties. An additional $180 million was appropriated for housing counseling. Now, similar to CDBG funding, 70% of funds will be distributed to localities and 30% to states. You can see in the handouts that I provided, Minnesota stands to benefit by about $58 million, of which $38.8 million goes to the Minnesota State Program, and Minneapolis and St. Paul receive about $5.6 and $4.3 million. And additional funds are dedicated to Anoka, Dakota, and Hennepin County. States and local governments must give priority emphasis and consideration to areas with the greatest need, including those with the greatest percentage of home foreclosures, the highest percentage of subprime mortgages, and those at risk of an increase in foreclosures. Funds must be committed within 18 months, and HUD is directed to ensure, to the maximum extent practicable and for the longest feasible term, that the homes in which funds are invested, for either rental or for sale, remain affordable consistent with eligibility and targeting requirements. The second key provision is an increase in housing bond authority. Now, this authority provides an additional $11 billion nationally in 2008 authority for states to issue tax-exempt bonds to support rental housing or homeownership. It also clarifies that unused authority from 2008 and 2009 can be carried forward, but those amounts must be carried forward, must be applied towards housing issues. The third key provision is an increase in low-income housing tax credits, which increased the amount of tax credits allocated to states by 20 cents per capita. The amount that Minnesota receives is set to increase by 10% in 2008 and just under 10% in 2009. In addition, it modifies HUD's income limit methodology for calendar year 2008 to require HUD to increase applicable area median income by the amount area median income rises, even if the HUD-determined AMI would be frozen under HUD's 07-08 income limit methodology. The fourth key provision is a capital magnet fund, which will award funds through a national competition to community development plans, financial institutions, or nonprofits that develop or manage affordable housing. This money is directed toward the development, preservation, rehabilitation, or purchase of affordable housing for primarily extremely low, very low, and low-income families. Economic development activities or community service facilities, which, in conjunction with affordable housing activities, must stabilize or revitalize a low-income area or underserved rural area. The final key provision is the establishment of a National Affordable Housing Trust Fund. This bill establishes a permanent housing trust fund to be administered by HUD, whose initial revenues come from the government-sponsored enterprises Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Initial funds will be directed to a home ownership program, after which a portion will be committed to the National Housing Trust Fund in fiscal year 2010. We estimate that nationally $300 million a year will be available once 100% of the funds are directed towards the Housing Trust Fund, of which, when phased in under current business levels, Minnesota would stand to receive approximately $3 to $5 million per year. No more than 10% of these funds must be used for administrative costs, after which states must use at least 90% for the production, preservation, rehabilitation, and operation of rental housing. 10% of the funds are available for first-time home buyers, and all assistance must be used to benefit very low-income families or those with incomes not greater than 50% of area median income, and at least 75% of the assistance must be used to benefit extremely low-income families or those with incomes not greater than 30% area median income. Minnesota Housing, as the administrator of these funds, has some discretion over their use, but 90% of funding must go to rental housing. The second important piece of legislation at the federal level is the overall housing and urban development budget. As you are aware, October 1st marked the deadline for Congress to pass their appropriations bills. Since no agreement was met, Congress passed a continuing resolution to assure funding of the federal government through March 6, 2009. Most programs will be funded at their current levels. Unfortunately, both the public housing and the project-based Section 8 accounts have consistently fallen short of the necessary funds for HUD to maintain these valuable programs. The federal government has significantly underfunded public housing agencies' operating subsidies for six consecutive years. In addition, agencies' annual funding for capital expenses, such as renovations and replacing aging appliances or systems, is too low to meet the needs that accumulate each year, let alone address the estimated $22 billion backlog they face in unmet needs. A similar lack of funding is in the project-based Section 8 account. As you're aware, the Section 8 project-based rental assistance program is a partnership between the federal government and private owners of rental housing who enter into contracts with HUD to provide housing for low-income families at affordable rents. HUD obligates 12 months of funding for each contract at renewal, thereby reassuring owners that housing assistance payments will be made for the full duration of the contract. In 07 and 08, property owners' confidence in the program deteriorated due to the funding shortfalls when HUD failed to request sufficient funding to meet its contractual obligations. We are expecting an additional $2.8 billion funding shortfall in 2009. Thousands of affordable Section 8 housing units are lost annually as owners choose to terminate their participation in the program. As owners lose confidence in the financial stability and reliability of this program, it becomes increasingly difficult to find willing owners to participate, leaving less available rental property for low-income renters. We will be advocating in the 111th Congress for the appropriation of sufficient resources to fund both public housing and cost-effective Section 8. The opportunity will come in the Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Fiscal Year 09 Appropriations Bill, and we would appreciate your support in seeking these funds and holding HUD accountable for maintaining the funding necessary to ensure low-income tenants can and will stay in their homes. We appreciate your continued concern and look forward to working with you on each of the issues I outlined today, both the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008 and the HUD budget. Thank you for your time and attention, and I welcome any comments or questions you might have.
Any questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the effects of the recent collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac having to do with this money available through those two agencies. Is that gone, or what has happened with that funding?
Okay, Madam Chair. Now, with the Fannie and Freddie takeover, the important thing to remember with the Housing Trust Fund is the first year of funding goes to a home ownership program. And the funding comes from 4.2 basis points of each dollar of the unpaid principal of Fannie and Freddie's total new business purchases. So it's not their revenues that will be affected. That's one point to keep in mind. Now, with the takeover, FHFA Director James Lockhart was granted the authority to temporarily suspend contributions to the Housing Trust Fund if he felt that it would threaten the financial stability of either Fannie or Freddie. Now, our argument is obviously that it's, at this point in time, it doesn't look as though it will affect the financial stability, particularly as nobody is talking about the initial funding from Fannie and Freddie affecting, that is directed to the home ownership program that's affecting the financial stability of Fannie and Freddie. And we're hoping that with an upturn in the economy and that the funds aren't from revenues, that we would be able to maintain the Housing Trust Fund.
Any other questions?
Okay, let's hang around because I think as we get some more information, we might be coming back to you again.
Great.
Thank you. Okay, next we'd like to hear from Tom Pender, House Research. We've asked Mr. Pender to give us an update on new federal law, which has, goes by various names. It's been called Rescue Package, it's been called Bailout, and I think the actual name is Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, 2008, is that right, Mr. Pender?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Pender. I'm with the House Research Department, and as Chair Clark said, I was asked to give a brief overview of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, generally known as the Federal Bailout Bill. And I'm scheduled for 15 minutes here, and the bill is 451 pages long. So this is going to be, as I say at the top of my handout there, a brief overview.
Well, I just want to say I really appreciate it. This bill just passed. And so one of the reasons that we really asked Mr. Pender to help us understand is that there's so many questions out there. Those of us who are talking with our constituents, they're asking, how does this affect us? This is just, we will hold you accountable only for everything that you know and nothing that has not yet been clarified. So hopefully this will help us all. And the interaction between this and the legislation we just heard about is some of what I find confusing, and I don't know if you'll have a chance to comment on that, but go ahead and start with the overview of the new law, please.
Madam Chair, I have a handout that's in the members' packet. It's a one-sheet, two-sided handout, and with copies for the audience. First, just an overview of the Act. What does it do? It gives the Treasury Department authority to buy what are called troubled assets from financial institutions. and the purpose is to provide liquidity for the economy and prevent insolvency. And basically here we're talking about mortgage loans and related assets, which are basically largely unmarketable right now, and they're on the bank's balance sheet. They restrict the ability of banks to lend. People are referring to them as the sludge in the money stream of the economy. Mm-hmm. And basically, the liquidity problem I think we're sort of familiar with. We're hearing about people who can't get mortgage loans, can't get car loans, can't get student loans. The states of Massachusetts and California last week notified the Treasury that they have short-term borrowing needs for the rest of this month, and they are not sure they're going to be able to meet those in the market, and that they may be asking the Federal Treasury for an emergency loan before the end of the month. So anyway, there's a lot of liquidity problems out there. So that's the bill that originally was voted down in the House, and the Senate later in the week revived the bill, resurrected it, and sometimes to do that you have to take out things that are controversial, and other times it works better to add things that people would like to vote for. And so what the Senate did is add the other items here that I list in this brief overview, temporarily increasing the FDIC insurance on accounts from $100,000 to $250,000. That expires at the end of 2009. Extending certain tax breaks that were scheduled to expire, and also add several new tax breaks, and almost all of those are not related to housing or the rest of the bill at all. And some of them are actually quite amusing. It would be fun to spend some time telling you about some of them, but time keeps me from doing that. Also, the bill...
Could I just ask you, though, could you just say a little bit about some of my discussion about, you know, the tax breaks at the top, tax breaks in the middle class? Is there a general thing you can say about these tax breaks?
I'd say that one thing they did was extend the relief from the alternative minimum tax, which generally falls on high income taxpayers who have high deductions of various kinds. There are tax subsidies for energy conservation and alternative energy. There are just a variety of miscellaneous tax breaks, many of them to benefit specific industries like the Puerto Rican rum industry and a variety of other kinds of things. But they're mostly unrelated to the rest of the bill. Also, the bill requires health insurance plans that cover mental health treatment, and that includes chemical dependency, to cover that on the same basis as other mental health coverage. This is called mental health parity. We've had a law like this in Minnesota since the mid-90s. And this bill in the Senate was actually a vehicle bill by which the Senate got this bill resurrected. They needed a House file to do this, and they happened to have in their possession the House file that was the mental health parity bill, which had passed the House. And so they took that bill, just as we do here in various times, and they amended on the federal bailout bill and sent it to the Senate for concurrence. So that was actually the vehicle bill. Another thing that the bill does is it requires reconsideration of what are called the mark-to-market accounting rules, and those are rules that went into effect recently. That just to summarize them roughly, they basically make companies show assets on their balance sheet based on something close to the current market value rather than what they paid for them. And obviously that's been a problem for institutions that hold a lot of these mortgage-related securities or mortgage loans themselves, because they've gone down in value a lot and people can't figure out what they are. So that's in here too. How much will the Act cost? The total authority in here to buy troubled assets is $700 billion, and that amount is being parceled out in three different lumps here that I describe in the handout. And then in addition to that $700 billion, the Act includes an additional roughly $110 billion cost for the tax breaks and the mental health parity provision. How will the act be paid for? The act doesn't raise any revenue, so it'll be paid for by the federal government issuing bonds, borrowing money, which will increase the national debt. And in fact, the bill includes a section specifically raising the limit on the national debt to accommodate this this bill. We have to remember, in looking at the cost of the bill, that the Treasury will be selling these assets that it buys at some point and will be getting something for them. So the amount it pays out for them is, we hope, not going to be a total loss, but that some of these assets will later be marketable and will be sold, or even if the Treasury holds on to them, that some of the homeowners will actually be making their mortgage payments, and so money will be coming in as a result of this. And the act is a little unclear, as quite a few things are, in effect, really, as to what the Treasury can do with the money that it gets for selling these assets, whether it can use it to buy more assets or whether it has to pay some part of it into the Treasury. Now I'm going to go on to talk about how the purchase of these troubled assets actually works. And a lot of the details of this we'll learn as the Treasury develops this program, but that the Act defines troubled assets as basically residential and commercial mortgage loans and assets such as securities that are related to those loans, which were created before March 14, 2008. And that happens to be the date that Bear Stearns was taken over. And I guess Congress decided that, if you created a new asset after that date, you knew what you were getting into. You knew that the market was in turmoil. So these mortgage-backed securities, mortgage-related assets involve mortgage-backed securities, which are shares in pools of mortgages, where someone securitized a pool of, say, 10,000 mortgages by putting them together in a package and then selling shares in that pool. And also collateralized debt obligations, which are one level more complex. It's basically where you've taken a bunch of those pools and put them together to create a new mega pool and sell shares in that asset, or have issued securities that are backed by those pools. The Act gives also, I might just add, just to show you the amount of discretion here, the bill also allows the Secretary of the Treasury to buy any other asset that the Secretary of Treasury thinks is essential for the, for the economy, to save the economy, and to buy it from any firm, not necessarily a financial institution. So there's some sort of extraordinary authority there for extraordinary situations.
Mr. Pender, not necessarily U.S.-based, I presume, as well?
There is a restriction that they be U.S.-based. It's not clear whether, if for instance, a foreign bank has a subsidiary that's based in the U.S., it appears that it could buy securities from that U.S. Subsidiary or related company, but it's not, that part of the Act, I think, is not completely clear.
Mm-hmm.
The Act gives the Treasury Department broad discretion to decide which assets to purchase, from whom to buy them, how to buy them, and what to do with them after the Treasury buys them. The bill lists a list of nine things that the Treasury is supposed to consider, and I include a few of them here in the handout. Quite a few of them are contradictory, where almost anything you do, it would help on one of those considerations and hurt on the other. So basically, I kind of envision the Treasury Department responding to this list by creating a form, and anything they do, they'll have to say on that form, how did they consider this particular consideration, and then have something at the bottom saying that, well, we decided to do this because we felt that on balance based on those considerations, would be a good thing to do. Obviously, the Treasury is going to have to pay more for these assets than their current market value. Otherwise, the banks could just sell them to somebody else in the market. So there's going to be some kind of premium as compared to market value. And the bill doesn't say, again, how the Treasury will decide how much premium to pay. It's expected the Treasury will buy these things through what's called a reverse auction, where the Treasury basically says, we want to buy $100 million worth of assets, maybe it's $100 billion worth of assets this month. We're taking offers. What are you willing to sell us and at what price? And then we'll sort through all these offers and decide whether we want to spend the whole $100 billion, and if so, which things seem to be the best things for us to buy, given the types of the assets, the price, who's selling them, because one of the considerations is that they should take into account protecting solvency of a financial institution, but they shouldn't waste their money on one that's going to go under anyway. So there are a variety of, there's a lot of discretion there. Firms from whom the Treasury buys these troubled assets have to agree to limits on executive compensation that are described in the Act. That includes no golden parachutes if the company ultimately goes insolvent. The employment contract or severance agreement can't have any incentives that are considered to be incentives to engage in extremely risky behavior on behalf of the company. The Act also has something that requires firms that sell troubled assets to the Treasury to give the federal government a chance to buy a financial stake in the company, to have warrants to buy stock or the right to buy senior debt in the company, so that if the company ends up benefiting by the Treasury's buying its assets, the Treasury can maybe recoup some of that by ending up having stock that is worth selling in the future and recouping some of the cost. Also, and this has been a kind of a controversial thing, the Act requires the Treasury to set up an alternative program that instead of buying troubled assets, the Treasury would offer to insure them. And the insurance premiums, in other words, ensure that they'll be paid, I guess is what it means. And the premiums would be risk-based and would be designed to cover the full cost of the insurance program. And as I said, there's been some controversy on this. Secretary Paulson says he does not plan to use that program at all. He didn't want it in the bill. And as some legislators take the opposite position, as I read the bill, it does require the secretary to set up the program, but it's not clear that it requires him to actually use the program. Also, it's expected that the Treasury is going to hire private firms to manage this whole process of buying, selling, deciding, you know, what to do with these troubled assets. And of course, guess where most of the expertise for that lies? It lies in firms that have recently gone under or firms that are in this industry in the first place. So there are going to be interesting issues in how to hire people to manage this program. Does the Act do anything to help homeowners who are in foreclosure? And again, the language is, you know, is a little vague, and we won't really know how significant it is until, you know, some months, at least in the future. But it requires all federal agencies that own mortgage loans to develop plans to minimize foreclosures and to work with mortgage servicers to encourage loan modifications consistent with net value to the taxpayers. So it sounds like there's some expectation there for federal agencies to give struggling homeowners some relief where it's possible and where mortgage servicers are willing to do it or even have the authority to do it. But it has to be consistent with net value to the taxpayer. So I guess if this looks like a mortgage that, well, if it's a mortgage loan the government already owns and the government seems to be better off by trying to keep the homeowner there, making maybe reduced payments as opposed to foreclosing, that the government is obligated to do something of that nature. Obviously, this is going to take again hiring personnel to do this, and there's been a shortage of those kind of personnel in the private sector. In looking to the future, this Act is not going to be implemented immediately. It's going to take a few weeks at least to get this thing up and running. The Act requires Secretary Paulson to have this thing set up to operate within 45 days after passage of the law, and so it's not going to have any direct immediate effect. I heard this morning that the The markets in Singapore and elsewhere went down this morning when they opened, and Russia had to close its market because things were so unstable. But, you know, the expectation of this might have an effect before it even goes into effect. If people feel like they know what it's going to be like and how it's going to help, it may have an effect before it actually operates. So anyway, that's my brief overview of the act, and be happy to answer any questions members have.
Well, maybe you could just clarify, this is a very strange way that we got into all this. Could you clarify for me how much the actual defaulting on mortgages played into this, and how much the credit default swaps, the pretend insurance around the possible default down the line, maybe that whole scheme, which of them actually got us into this situation? If it had been just the credit the defaulting on mortgages, we would have had a bump down, or maybe more, I don't know. But how much was it the playing with the idea that we could make money off the possibility that these are going to go down that actually got us into this? Can you just describe some of that for me, Andy?
I really can't put a percentage on, you know, how much of one thing versus how much of the other. I think one factor here is that these mortgage-backed securities have been very hard for people to figure out what they're worth, and I think that's been a factor in making them just something that people don't want to buy. That they're, you know, these mortgage loans have been packaged and pooled, they've been sliced and diced into various tranches, and so it's hard for somebody to evaluate a pool of 10,000 mortgages and decide, you know, how many of them are in default, how many are in foreclosure, how many might go into default soon, what's the quality of the loans in the total pool. So I can't really you know, put a percentage on what percent caused this problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pender, I have a couple questions. Can you cover the, supposedly in the legislation there's some type of relief that court could provide a homeowner if they couldn't make their payment? Do you know anything about that?
Madam Chair and Senator Vanderveer, I think what you're referring to is something that some legislators wanted to have in the bill, the ability for a bankruptcy court to basically rewrite a mortgage, to change the terms of a mortgage, to spread out the payments or reduce the interest rate, or make that kind of adjustment. And that item was not in the version that failed in the House, and it was not in the version that the Senate resurrected and that was ultimately passed. But it was certainly under discussion and something that a lot of members of Congress wanted to have in the bill.
And secondly, Madam Chair, Mr. Pender, do we know, it looks like there's $810 billion in the one bailout provision. Do we know how much that Freddie and Fannie's deal is going to cost? Any idea what that estimates on that?
Madam Chair and Senator Vanderveer, I don't know what the estimates on that are.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, there's going to have to be more hearings at the federal level as well as here, but we thought we'd at least try. And I'm glad you asked that question about what can the bankruptcy courts do. What I am noting, though, in your summary, that it does say that the Treasury Department, who is now in charge of everything, they must consider among their factors the need to help families keep their homes and stabilize communities. So that is one of the requirements. What that means is what we don't know. Is that right? What that actually means is that the mechanism is what's not spelled out.
Madam Chair, that's right, and also how that factor will get weighed among the other factors that the federal agencies have to consider, how much priority they put on that.
Well, this committee is very interested in being a voice to raise that issue over and over, and I hope that committee members who are here today and others will just keep asking the question about how that's going to work. And we need to ask our people at the federal level, and so we're going to have a chance to hear from some of our federal folks, although I know they're not specifically speaking to this issue, but I know that, you know, they will play some role in a little while. Representative Dorn, do you have another question?
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. Pender, you are a very nice man. I give you a lot of credit this morning for coming here and talking to us about this. You did a great summary with this. So I just want to clarify again, because I want to be sure I understand this. I've got a homeowner who I knocked on her door this past weekend. She makes $40,000 a year. Her ex-spouse is almost $10,000 behind in his child support. She can't get any case management at the county for that because of the cuts we've had there. She's not getting any additional support, and she makes $40,000 a year, and she's 4 months behind in her mortgage. Does this bill do anything to help her?
Madam Chair and Representative Madore, the bill requires that once the federal government owns a mortgage loan, that it consider providing some kind of help, subject to, you know, agreements with the mortgage servicers and, you know, everybody else that has an interest in the mortgage and so on. So it requires them to basically consider doing that once the government actually owns that loan or securities that are based on that loan.
Madam Chair, again, Mr. Pender, you are a very nice man. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Madore, I was reading in the New York Times this morning that a lady, 90-year-old lady who was about to be served with eviction, shot herself in the chest, and then Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac decided to forgive her loan. It sounds like a rather extreme solution for your constituents. But I wanted to ask Mr. Pender, looking at these Ponzi schemes, is what I consider them, reaching some economists estimate at $100 trillion worldwide. Can the Treasury Department, as far as you can tell, buy these with paper at face value if it chose to do so? And the question is an important one to me, because then all the criticism that many people are leveling at this agreement is given added credence, I would think. Do you know how much leeway the Secretary of Treasury has in that regard, since we know that much of this paper is almost unknowable as far as its value?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, the bill prohibits buying assets at a profit to the financial institution. But as far as the face value, the bill doesn't deal with that. It simply says that gives the Treasury authority to buy troubled assets based on trying to achieve the objectives of the bill of improving solvency and liquidity in the financial sector.
Madam Speaker. Just a quick follow-up. Would it be possible, do you think, you know, and of course this is a big bill and wouldn't expect you to have a definitive answer to it, but would it be possible for the Treasury Department to, in fact, see to it that these companies that were engaging in this activity could for themselves recoup all their losses, and those funds would go in that direction rather than assisting people whose mortgages are being foreclosed? Is that possible within the legislation, as far as you can see? You know, the issue for many people is, well, this is another bailout for the
for the big guys who played this game and lost, and now they would like the taxpayers to pick up the bill. As far as you can tell in this legislation, which was so quickly written, would that be a possibility?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Let me try again.
Well, maybe I don't either, but that's possible. But I guess what I'm asking is, does the Treasury Department have enough leeway so that if the Secretary of Treasury, that many people criticize because of his connections with many of these same institutions who have engaged in this activity, would it be possible for him, if he chose, or the Treasury Department, in spite of the directives that are given in the legislation, that they could, in fact, see to it that the companies that were engaging in bundling all these mortgages and so would be first in line to get relief, rather than the intent that some hope that people who are being foreclosed could be the first in line to get relief. In other words, the people who played the game will get off free, in a sense, at taxpayers' expense. I think that's the view in the public that many people have about this legislation. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, the bill gives the Secretary of the Treasury really broad discretion on what to buy and on what terms, and based primarily on overall benefit to the economy. So I think that's the central theme, and if the Secretary can justify buying particular assets from particular companies on that basis, the bill probably gives the Secretary the authority to do that.
So we just need to see if the transparency part of the bill will allow us eventually to monitor how we did all that. That's the best we have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
A minute, quick comment, and then I know we have someone who's leaving the council.
Well, as I've been listening to things about this whole mess, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it really doesn't come down to the fact that we had subprime mortgages, and, I mean, the core of the problem gets down to the subprime mortgages and the people defaulting on their mortgages. But in fact, the thing that has put us into this precarious situation is what has been done with those, as not only as they've been pooled together, but as then the creative minds came up with innovative ways to handle the risk, which is insurance, which is not real insurance, just saying that if this that I hold or that somebody else holds goes down, I have insurance to cover it. But this insurance scheme is really where the Ponzi scheme is, where people had a great deal of profiting from nothing. That set up our whole financial system to be based on this craziness. That when it broke, it de-liquefied the entire system. It froze up the entire system. So there's no money to go out because nobody knows where they can safely lend it out. So our problem is that the system isn't working because everything's frozen. That's the problem. The problem isn't that homeowners are defaulting on their mortgages. That's deep, deep, deep down inside it. In order to even consider where we're going to help out people defaulting on their mortgages or just simply life in general, going to the store and buying food, the only way we're going to deal with those things is to get this thing unfrozen so that things can start to move again, and then we can relook at what are the regulations around how we come up with these creative ideas. How far do we go in just saying it's a free market, go for it, because it shouldn't be. This is that's another subject, but that's a total theory. We really need to have more control about how we approach these things, and as it's gone, it has gone way out of hand, and we are all in serious trouble that has far more to do with more homeowners defaulting on their mortgages or losing their home. It has to do with whether this thing gets so bad that we go to cup food and there's no food on the shelf. I mean, this is a serious, serious situation for around the entire globe.
Mm-hmm.
This is to cry for foul for the holders of the mortgages
is almost a discussion for another day. It almost is. It is the core of it down at the very bottom. But the problem is the frozen liquidity in the markets, the frozen credit, and we need to solve that. And this is an attempt. This whole bill is an attempt to do that. We don't really know if it's going to work. We hope it does.
Okay, I think with that we're going to move on because you said, I think, a lot in just a short period of time about the whole rescue so-called bill. We need to go back, I think, and focus on what we do have before us as well today, which is the Federal Housing and Economic Recovery Act, which is a specific strategy and a specific piece of legislation that is underlying that. So if we're going to call next on the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, our HUD folks are going to come on forward. I think you have to leave, so we'll maybe get you right up there. And I want to thank you for coming today. You've been hearing the testimony so far. I know that you want to focus on the part that you have your hands on, which is the legislation that was passed in July and the dollars that we saw in Minnesota. But I think it's important, you know, people here are trying to put the two together, try to understand what connection there might be with what the new resources and so on that's coming with the so-called rescue bill. But so focus on what you can, and if you have some comments or connections to make, we'll be glad to hear them.
Thank you. My name is Dexter Sidney. I'm the Director for Housing and Urban Development for Minnesota. And I'm accompanied by Anita Olson, who is the head of FHA for Minnesota. And I thought that perhaps, since Linda Harris did such an excellent job in giving us an overview of the Neighborhood Stabilization Act, I can talk about that a little bit. But also I would like to maybe have Anita talk more about FHA and the new programs that it's come out with, and because that's something that really hasn't been touched upon today. However, let me just go right into the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. Again, Minnesota received $57.7 million, and I have some handouts that Mr. Raleigh is going to provide to each of you. You already have them? Good. Okay. I would direct your attention to the one single sheet. Here on the back, it shows exactly what each community is going to receive in addition to the state of Minnesota. And I think that, you know, in terms of being able to exercise this program, it's critical. I want to just bring up a couple of things. Number one, the government really wants this money to work quickly, okay? One of the things that they are doing is actively encouraging local governments to coordinate with each other and with their state governments, implementing these programs that may require area-wide or even regional approach. And so I think that it's very clear that there's a certain urgency that Congress had with the passage of this initiative. And so I believe that one of the key things is that those who are due to receive money need to get their plans in as quickly as they possibly can, make them as thorough as they can, and then be able to expend those funds in an 18-month window. Okay. So I think that those are the most important elements of this particular bill. And I want to reemphasize again the four main areas that communities can do with this money. They can buy foreclosed homes. They can buy land and property. They can demolish or rehabilitate abandoned properties. They can offer down payment and closing cost assistance to low and moderate income home buyers. And in addition to that, they can also create land banks to assemble and temporarily manage and dispose of vacant land for the purpose of stabilizing neighborhoods and encouraging the reuse or development of property. So again, our local office will stand ready in terms of providing answers or hopefully guidance to the various communities that have been outlined as having receiving these funds. And so with that, I'll open it up to any questions, and I'm going to refer to Anita, who can talk about the FHA program, which is equally important. In so doing, I want to just give you a brief overview of FHA for Minnesota. Right now, there are 64,000 active FHA loans in Minnesota, which indicates that was not the product that people were led into with these subprime mortgages. Out of that 65,000, there are only 400 that are in foreclosure right now statewide, okay? So I think had people gotten into an FHA mortgage, we probably wouldn't be seeing
the severity of the issue as it is right now today. And one of the unknown things about FHA, and this is a plug for them, is that if something happens to you, if life happens, a divorce, illness, sickness, a death in the family, that insurance will kick in and make your monthly mortgage payment for up to 12 months. And not very many people know that. And how many people would have been able to benefit from this had that occurred way back when they took out their mortgage? So, again, I wanted to reemphasize that, you know, FHA has been America's good old friend since 1934, where over 35 million homes have been financed. And so I think we're getting back to the old days, if you will. The old days of saving for a home, saving for a down payment, saving for things that, that you need inside that house rather than buying them on credit. The economy has hit a wall. And so I think that we're having to go back to the old way of doing things. And with that, I'm going to pass this over to Anita, who can walk you through some of the new programs that HUD has initiated for FHA.
Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself, please.
I'm sorry?
I said welcome to the committee, and if you would just introduce yourself,
absolutely,
please, for the case.
Sure, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Anita Olson, and I oversee FHA financing for the state of Minnesota, in addition to several other things that I do on the side with the department. Dexter asked me to come today to talk about the home ownership side of things, and what I'd like to lead off in your package is the announcement of the Housing Counseling Agency NOFA funding was announced this morning. Minnesota has been very successful over the years in applying through with 38 HUD-approved housing counseling agencies in the state of Minnesota, and approximately $700,000 are coming into the state with direct housing counseling agencies, and $1,300,000 is coming into a national intermediary that works with the HOPE Alliance, which is another creation of a year ago of housing counseling. Housing counseling is extremely important when it comes to home ownership. In your package also, I have printed out for you the FHA.gov. That's our main website, and the new rollout of the Hope for Homeowners, which is a byproduct of the legislation that was signed in July, the HURA Act. The Hope for Homeowners program is actually a product, and it was a creation of FDIC, Federal Reserve, and FHA, sitting for 2 months creating this program. And this program has got a lot of detail to it. The department rolled out its own FHA Secure a year ago, which I'm going to give you just brief overview of the two programs, because I'm all about home ownership, and that's what my piece is all about. There's all kinds of other things that are going on right now with the neighborhood stabilization and all of that, but what I'm focusing in on is how is FHA helping with the homeowners, because I hear questions like, how is this hitting Main Street? How is this helping the borrower that's making $45,000 a year, she's got some financial issues, and I have all kinds of questions that I wrote down about that particular one because it's much bigger than just those two things. Mm-hmm. So the two programs that FHA has rolled out to assist borrowers at this point was FHA Secure, that was rolled out last September, and it allows for and will continue to the end of the year with possible extension depending on the need. FHA Secure allows for a borrower to refinance into a first FHA at appraised value. Now, if the current appraised value is less than what's owed on the mortgage that they're currently sitting in, it allows for a provision to do a second mortgage. And that second mortgage can be held by the original mortgage company or by the new mortgage company that's originating the first FHA. The second mortgage can or cannot have payments associated with it. And it's a factor that they can actually come in with the first FHA, current appraised value, and that second mortgage could not have payments due until the loan is sold or financed. So the FHA Secure is still in place and good till the end of the year. And we have originated over 300,000 refinances into the FHA Secure since it rolled out last September.
I think that's a question about that. Who decides whether or not it has payments associated with it or not? Is it the local bank that's doing the mortgage, originating the mortgage? Who actually decides that?
Correct. It is the determination of the current debt that's owed. So if a $100,000 current appraised value is going into an FHA and the current debt is $125,000, that $25,000 second can sit there with or without payments, and the determination is made by the financial institution if they want to instill payments on that $25,000. And that's an example for you.
Well,
But what kind of guidelines are they following? Are there FHA guidelines that they must follow?
No, the second will be a note that's held by that original mortgage company or us. It's not an FHA second mortgage.
So it's still a private sector decision. There's no guidelines from the
correct
federal government.
And if they determine we're not going to ask for payments now on that $25,000 in the example, then they do not have to factor that into the FHA criterion because if it's over 3 years, which is a factor for the homeowner as well, but to stabilize them in the $100,000 loan, fixed rate, FHA secure, and the $25,000 then can be dealt with at a later date.
Yeah, missing something, but what is the incentive for the local bank to, you know, help this family out rather than continue along the way it's been doing in the past? Some of our mortgage companies, I mean, they're the ones that have been causing some of the problems. So,
right. Well, the incentive also relies a lot on the borrower. Can the borrower qualify for the A-paper FHA loan? There are no provisions for reducing the requirements for a borrower to qualify. That's why we have such a low foreclosure rate in the country, quite frankly, and in Minnesota, really low, because the borrowers are qualifying on their income and their credit. So the incentive would also be the fact, can they qualify for the FHA first mortgage?
What does one call for that? If they've got bad credit because they're in trouble right now, how is this going to help them?
If they are in an interest-only and adjustable rate that's adjusting quite often and they're it's pricing them out of the affordability that Chip talked about, that what we were told back in September when we rolled out the FHA Secure, that there's a pool of borrowers that got into a mortgage that is not a successful wealth-building mortgage for them.
Right.
They didn't know about FHA, or the bank they went to didn't offer FHA, VA, RD, any government lending. This is an opportunity for them to stabilize into a government loan.
Okay, well, maybe it'll become clear as we go on. I'll just let you proceed.
I'm
not quite sure I understand it.
The new program that just rolled out on October 1 is Hope for Homeowners, or we're calling it H for H. And at FHA.gov, there are several handouts around this program, and it is just new. But essentially, the way the program is going to work, a borrower will be able to refinance into an FHA at the current appraised value, 90% of the current appraised value. Anything above that 90% will be written off by the industry. So that's the difference between the FHA Secure, where the lender would be able to secure any outstanding amount with a second mortgage. Hope for Homeowners allows for the borrower to get a first FHA 90% of the current appraised value, and everything else is written off. They go into the loan with a 10% equity position. Now, the responsibility of the homeowner getting into this loan, because you're probably going, oh, that sounds pretty good. There is a responsibility for that borrower that they will have to, the 10% equity position will be shared with FHA, and any future appreciation on that loan will be shared with FHA. And there's a calculation at FHA.gov that shows that what those calculations will be. So there's a responsibility of the homeowner that if they do choose to get into the Help for Homeowner product, there will be a responsibility for that homeowner for life of loan. So that's the difference between the two.
Is there any requirement that the mortgage agency, the bank, or whatever, discloses these opportunities to the people who are right now in trouble with them in terms of their mortgages?
There's a whole marketing campaign that is being worked on right now as we speak. The requirements for the lender with an FHA loan right now, they are mandated by sending out a trifold of all of their options. Whether the servicing lenders of their portfolio will be mandated to send out information on the FHA Secure and the Help for Homeowners, or Hope for Homeowners, I'm not sure of, but I know that there's going to be a huge marketing campaign around this program.
And that's going to be coming from your agency? That marketing campaign is going to be coming through your agency, from your agency?
Yes, and I'm going to be part of that as well.
All right.
A lot of training, a lot of information sessions. I have presented to over 3,100 industry partners in just Minnesota alone in the last year, talking about all of these different products. And just to give you an example, August of 07 in Minnesota, 590 families got an FHA loan. 590, August 07. August 08, 2,700 families got into an FHA. This is origination. So those numbers were always there. Even in the day when we were 35% of the market, we were originating 25 to 3,000 loans every month. So those borrowers are still out there. And the industry is very happy to hear that those borrowers are still out there. We're connecting them now. The industry is connecting them with the FHA.
Madam Chair, we also, I'd like to mention one thing, that under the leadership of Tim Marks and his staff, FHA and also Minnesota Housing created the first memorandum of understanding in the nation that will enable both organizations to work together in education and co-branding of the product, so that it's really the first of its kind. So I don't know if Tim is still here or not.
Yeah, we're going to be hearing from him shortly.
So it was really a very exciting moment for us, and Tim and the FHA commissioner signed that in June. And so we're working together, essentially for training, home ownership, counseling, and we're really excited about that.
Any questions? Mr. Sidney, Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, I'm reading through your information here. What is the geographical limit? Saying here that you can't loan out more than a geographical limit. What is that for the metro area here in Minnesota?
For FHA, lending limits right now in the metro 13 counties is $365,000. That's good till the end of the year. HERA also allowed for changes to increase FHA limits, and those will go into effect January 1, but we don't know what that's going to be at this point. They're talking about the combination of 150% of the median and so on and so forth. But we're up from 276,000 that we were before the temporary increase happened. So we were able to, here in Minnesota, address the gap between the 276,000 to the 365. So we were able to refinance the 325s, the 350s into the FHA.
Thank you.
Any further comments or questions? I had an opportunity to talk to you just very briefly before the committee, and I just want to put it on the record here. In terms of your agency's opportunities that may be expanding under the rescue bill, the bail bill, whatever you want to call it, you apparently have not been informed what that might be yet. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So Treasury has not notified you that they want you to be one of the vehicles that would be available to bring in, you know, send some of that $700 billion.
I'm not aware of anything at this point, Madam Chair.
Yeah. I hope that question gets answered because some of the mechanisms you have seem like they might be useful, and seems like there's so much discretion, there's no reason why you wouldn't be part of it. All right. Well, is any other questions? All right. Then we thank you very much. I think you gave us a lead in right into Mr. Mark from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Welcome to the committee, and I guess is this going to be the last time we get to hear from you as our commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair, members it is, and thank you for all of the opportunities and all of the support over the years.
And just for the record, that Mr. Marks is moving on to state, is it?
I'll be going to New York City. I'm executive director of an organization called Common Ground.
Right. So while we've got you here, help us understand what you can about the implementation of this federal law.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tim Marks. I'm commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, or Minnesota Housing. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you this morning. You've received an extensive briefing already on the rescue package passed last week and the Housing Economic Recovery Act passed by Congress in July. So I'll try to keep my comments relatively brief. I did provide a summary that is in your packet that I'll talk from briefly as to how the legislation may be implemented in Minnesota. And I will focus primarily as it relates to the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, and also talk about one potential opportunity that may, underline may exist with the recently passed legislation on the Rescue Act. Yes. To let you know that Minnesota Housing has been working very aggressively on the whole foreclosure subprime and related issues since 2006. We've helped found and provided support for the Foreclosure Prevention Council that testified before you today and will testify again.
And we've been working with other state agencies, particularly the Department of Commerce, on the whole series of issues that surround the foreclosure crisis. We have been focusing our strategies on prevention and remediation, and through a combination of sources, state, federal, private, and Minnesota Housing Agency resources, we've invested over this period of time about $30 million in various efforts to prevent foreclosures and provide remediation. The root of the problem, as you know and have talked about, is that we have not paid attention in the homeownership industry to good banking and financial practices, and to understanding and evaluating risk and making sound decisions based upon risk. And we have not focused on long-term sustainable homeownership and understanding that renting is a good option for many. Now, that has not been true for all aspects of the homeownership industry. As Director Sidney pointed to, the basic FHA program and the basic Minnesota housing program continues to focus, and through this entire period of time, focused on long-term sustainable homeownership and has focused on making sure that homeowners make good decisions if they take out a mortgage product for a homeowner. So our $1.8 billion, the state of Minnesota's $1.8 billion loan portfolio of first mortgages through Minnesota Housing, 19,000 loans, is sound and is performing well. We are continuing, however, to monitor the situation very closely and are concerned and will be concerned about rising levels of unemployment as it will affect our portfolio's performance. This administration, the Plenty administration, has been very active at the national level in encouraging bipartisan action on federal legislation to help our housing and our general economy recover. And we're pleased that Congress has acted and the President has acted aggressively. What I thought might be helpful is to go through some of the major provisions of the Housing Economic Recovery Act and what it means for Minnesota. First, the housing bond provisions, entities throughout the state of Minnesota receive an additional $162.8 million of bonding authority to issue mortgages to first-time homebuyers, $48 million of that to Minnesota Housing, and roughly that could be about 1,300 new mortgages. In addition, to address the concerns in the rental market that Mr. Halbach referred to, we received an additional 20 cents per capita for 2008 or 2009, or about $1 million each year in housing tax credits. And they made various other improvements to both of these programs that will make them easier to use and allow the ability to reach lower incomes. The problem is that because of the seize up in the credit market, we have been unable to effectively utilize these tools, particularly the mortgage revenue bonds. For example, just a week before last, we were going to go to market with significant additional mortgage revenue bonds and had that proposal before our board. We pulled that item because of the interest rate that we would have had to offer on those bonds would have been totally uneconomical. And this is something that's affecting housing finance agencies throughout the country. And as a result of this credit crisis, the lack of liquidity in the market, we are unable to get financing to first-time homebuyers when there is a lot of a good product at affordable prices out there. It's a very unfortunate situation, and we hope this clears up soon. One of the things that we are doing at the state level through our national association is having regular calls with our fellow agencies and our sibling agencies throughout the country to monitor the situation and to advocate for and figure out new strategies to attempt to finance as much housing as possible. But the credit markets are not being cooperative at this point. You heard from Anita Olson from the HUD and the FHA about the Hope for Homeowners program, which allows refinancing to 90% of the current market value. It is important to emphasize that that is a voluntary program with lenders, that they have to agree to refinance down to that level, and we are uncertain. We have not gone through all the program details that Ms. Olson referred to. We are not certain to the extent that program will actually be utilized, but we will hope it will be utilized. We are prepared to be a purchaser of those refinance mortgages through authority that Congress gave us with that additional mortgage revenue bond authority. So we'll partner with that program to the extent that it can be an effective program. The next item is the foreclosure counseling funding. That is a critical part of addressing the foreclosure crisis. With the foreclosure funding passed in the last Congress, Minnesota received the second largest award in the country. Just behind California, we received $4.3 million. That essentially allowed us to triple our counseling capacity in Minnesota to prevent the foreclosures, primarily administered by the Homeownership Center of Minnesota. And we just put in an application last week or the week before last to draw down hopefully some of that additional resources that would allow us to sustain this capacity. You have heard as well about the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, the $3.92 billion passed by Congress, of which Minnesota will receive a $57.7 million program. The award to the state is $38.8 million. And Director Sidney talked about the eligible uses of that program to acquire, foreclose, and abandon properties, to acquire blighted structures, and to get them back into productive use, and to do land banking. That program will be administered through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Katie Lindblad, Assistant Commissioner for Community Development, will be charged on behalf of the agency of leading that effort, and we will be cooperating with other state agencies, including Commerce, Deed, and the Met Council, to get their input and coordinate resources they might have as well. An important factor to consider is that in a number of communities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, and Anoka counties, receive their individual allocations of these resources. The fact that they receive their individual allocations does not preclude us from providing additional resources to those communities. And we will be working with all of them to coordinate our resources to use them strategically. We are directed by the legislation, by the federal legislation, to allocate the resources available to Minnesota Housing, that $38.8 million, to communities and to areas that have the highest preponderance of foreclosures, that have the highest preponderance of subprime mortgages, or are at risk of those. So we do anticipate that those that did receive their own specific allocations will get additional resources for Minnesota Housing. Now, the good news that for those that maybe be expecting some of these resources, but may because of the federal criteria and how we allocate them, may not get these resources, is that by receiving this money, we are not under significant pressure or as significant pressure to use the other housing resources that are available to us through state appropriated programs, through other federal programs, and through agency resources. And those resources will continue to be available to meet statewide housing needs. So those federal resources are really important for us to target on the foreclosure problem and also to be able to continue to use resources to focus on statewide housing needs so that the situation which Mr. Halbach outlined for you does not get worse and can hopefully improve. Mr. Sidney articulated the eligible uses. One important aspect of the legislation is that these funds must be used in 18 months. So there's a rapid timeline by which these resources must be used. They must be under contract for actual use, not just allocated to jurisdictions or allocated developers. The process is that we and those that are receiving or are eligible to receive this money must have a plan to HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, by December 1. There will be an opportunity for public comment. We anticipate having a draft available for comment by November 7 so that we can meet that December 1 deadline. And we have already begun that process of meeting with stakeholders about how best to use these resources. One particular use that we are exploring is that, as Mr. Halbach pointed out, we are experiencing, because of the economic downturn and because of tenants being put out of foreclosed homes, an increase in shelter use. It may be that we can find the ability to use these resources to acquire foreclosed or abandoned or blighted properties and allow them to be used for rental purposes and to prevent the increased use of our shelters. We'll be exploring that aggressively. We are aware that those organizations upon whom we depend to administer and do the real work with this product will have significant capacity needs in terms of being able to have the staff and the infrastructure to be able to use these resources well, and we'll be looking at that and working with that to resolve them. We will be looking at a very streamlined application process for the use of these resources so that, again, we can get them out the door for the intended use as soon as possible. And we are going to seek to leverage these resources to achieve other strategic purposes, including coordinating with resources of the private sector, trying to make sure that we are targeting so we can revitalize core neighborhoods, to try to increase the energy efficiency of homes and other properties that will receive these funds, so that as we do this, we can coordinate where we target resources so that it can be coordinated with transportation and job location, so that we can be efficient in terms of looking at the entire household budget of those whom we serve. In addition, this could be a wonderful way to get the private sector, our construction laborers, to work, and there's been a softening in their ability to work and to use these resources for that purpose. In addition, there is a lot of bad news, but we can use these resources as well as others, hopefully, once the liquidity crisis hopefully calms down. This is a good time to be a first-time home buyer. Once we can get around the credit issue and make sure there's credit available, and these resources can be used for that as well, there is a lot of good, affordable, quality product on the market at reasonable prices, as well as resources for rehabilitation. A part of the good news here is that Minnesota Housing has been working at this since 2006. And we have provided resources for rehabilitation already. There are many networks and remediation plans that have been worked on or in place, and we'll be calling from the best of those to use these resources. One comment before I conclude, just about the rescue package recently adopted, is that the Treasury is allowed to purchase and then figure out how to dispose of or otherwise turn around troubled assets, which essentially could be these collateralized debt obligations, the pools of subprime mortgages, which again result or ultimately come down to individual mortgages. We have begun conversations with our HFA, Housing Finance Agency colleagues across the country, as to whether it might be an opportunity for us as agencies perhaps to acquire in some way some of those assets, those mortgages, as it applies to our state, so that we can manage them in order to best, to our ability, keep people in their homes. I'm not sure whether that is possible yet, but that is something that we are looking at. My final comment is, as we have worked with our colleagues throughout the country and begun work on this plan, I want to give you confidence that Minnesota is in the best position among our colleague states throughout the country to use these resources well. We have a long-term network of well-performing both nonprofit and for-profit developers, of intermediary organizations, and advocacy groups that really do perform well in meeting Minnesota housing needs. And they are prepared, I know, to step up and be held accountable and deliver on the results with this program as well. And so you can have confidence that in this very difficult situation, Minnesota is positioned very, very well to put these resources to their best possible use. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions.
I've got a couple. Start with you. Now, there's a deadline for us to get this plan in, and where are we at on that deadline, and what are the specific plans for the public input and the public hearings? And if I need to have a lot of hearings, the attorneys are, legislators are, you guys going to be doing some hearings as an agency, or what is the plan for that, and how we, you know, what is the deadline, how are you doing on the deadline?
Madam Chair, members, the deadline is that we have to have a plan to HUD by December 1, which means we think in order to accommodate a public comment period, which can be internet-based, we have to have a plan out there for public availability by November 7th. But we have already begun the process of sitting down with the cities and nonprofit organizations and those that have been working on the various remediation plans. We've been part of the remediation plan process. So that is something that we will continue to sponsor meetings with our stakeholders to get their ideas and to otherwise figure out how best to construct this plan. Assistant Commissioner Lindblad, as well as other Minnesota housing staff and staff from other organizations, are on their way as we speak to Washington for a meeting with HUD and Treasury to dig more deeply into this program to understand it much better so we can put the resources in place. Our commitment is to be as transparent as we possibly can so that folks know what we are doing and know what they can expect, but there is a tight timeline, and so we're going to have to ask our partners and collaborators to be nimble as well in terms of participating in this program. The fact is they already are, and we're having meetings constantly on this.
Okay, you're having meetings constantly on this, and is this a matter, I really don't know about those meetings, maybe other legislators do. I think some of us would like to know, especially those of us who are involved in housing. Is there a way that we can get some public announcements out there for the... And now, one of the things that's happening with housing members is we're all involved in elections. Mm-hmm. So if you send us some announcements and we miss them, I apologize. But I don't know, have there been announcements?
Madam Chair, members, this program just came out last week. Okay, so we got the notice of official announcement of this program on September 30th. We were invited to a briefing by HUD in Washington that is beginning tomorrow.
You're talking about the final bill that just passed there?
No, I'm talking about the bill that was passed in July that allocated the $3.92 billion and the 57.7, which the state will get. The actual amount of allocations and the determination and the deadlines was just published on September 30th.
Okay,
so that is the time what we received. And we have to have a plan in place by December 1st. So we have to move very quickly in order to draw down these resources. Again, we anticipate having a draft plan by November 7th for broader public consumption. We will make sure that legislators and others have access to that plan for any comments that they have. And as we have worked on this entire issue over the last year and a half or 2 years, it has been through a very collaborative process with local governments, with nonprofit housing groups, with lenders and others. And we will be convening meetings with those stakeholders as we prepare this draft plan. And if you have any, or committee members have any specific issues or things that you want to make sure that are covered or questions about that plan, I encourage you to contact us through our legislative liaison, and we'll take that into consideration as we develop this draft plan.
Thank you. I understand you're talking about the guidelines and the rules for the housing, the HERA.
Yeah, the Neighborhood Stabilization Funds allocated under the Broad Housing Economic Recovery Act.
I think I'm going to start calling it HERA. It's easier to say, the Housing Economic Recovery Act. Under that, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, you're saying those guidelines just came out last week.
Yes.
Apparently just a day or two before the passage of the rescue bill. Right? So what's, I think, confusing to some of us is to try to understand. I think that rescue bill, or whatever we want to call it, has a deep impact on the previous HERA bill and the Neighborhood Stabilization Program's options. It seems to me like, as you mentioned it towards the end of your testimony, there might be some big options there that would allow our state agencies to have more opportunities to use some of that $700 billion. I mean, I'm trying to understand. I don't think, I'm not asking you to have the answer, but I do think it is a little confusing for the public and for those of us who are trying to keep our minds clear about what the opportunities are and what we might be asking our state agency. So, for example, and I know you won't be here to do this, but MHFA will be coming in with a budget proposal to the governor. And I'm curious how either of those two provisions will, either of those two separate acts will be affecting what will be proposed to our governor and by our governor. And I don't know if you have any insights that you can give us at this point in time, but that is one of the questions that seems to me is certainly on my mind and certainly I'm sure on other legislators' minds.
Madam Chair, members, we will have to be moving aggressively to develop and implement our plan under HERA well before a state appropriated budget is adopted by you, which will go into effect next July 1. I think one factor that we obviously will consider, and I would suspect the governor will consider as he considers the budget, is that we now have $57 million of additional resources available for this purpose that we didn't previously have, and that is good news in order to relieve the pressure on the funding of other housing programs. And I think this will give the agency and the governor and the legislature the opportunity to understand how HERA is being implemented and whether there are any additional gaps that are appropriate to be filled in with any additional state resources that might be available. But right now, that's just simply too premature, we believe, to talk in detail about.
And when does the governor ask for the recommendations to come forward from your agency?
My belief, Madam Chair, members, is that we will be getting preliminary budget instructions sometime in October. And obviously, once the next forecast comes out, that's when, and I believe that will be early December, that's when the budgeting process from the governor's perspective, once we know what resources are available, will begin in earnest.
Okay. One of the things I want to clarify, and I'm going to see if anybody else has questions, but I think you mentioned, and it was mentioned by Mr. Pender, too, there's a lot, the actual provisions of the recent law and does allow for a voluntary, and I believe also with the HERA program, some voluntary compliance by the lending agencies, right? There's not a mandate here yet. Is that something, I guess, that we could put into state law that would provide some guidelines? Otherwise, it sounds like it's pretty voluntary on part of the lending agencies. Is that right?
Madam Chair, members, I think the two provisions that you're referring to are, one is part of the HERA Act passed in July, the Hope for Homeowners.
The Hope for Homeowners.
Which provides an opportunity for refinancing, but again, that's a voluntary program. And the second relates to the relationship between the troubled asset acquisition and disposition and the encouragement, strong encouragement, that the recently passed legislation provided the Treasury to try to use that in a way that will help help homeowners. And again, I'm sure that will be the subject of ongoing evaluation and consideration, both federally and then as the state looks at its situation when the legislature convenes and as it deliberates.
Do you have any parting recommendations for us on how we might put that together?
Madam Chair, members, as I think my parting recommendations would be to evaluate the situation very carefully, understand the facts that exist at the time when you convene, and have some hearings at that time once you know the fiscal situation, once you know the extent to which the legislation, both the troubled asset acquisition program and the Hope for Homeowners program, how it's actually working and assisting homeowners, and determine what additional actions may be appropriate at that time. That's the only thing I can recommend. In the meantime, I think it's really important that we all get the word out to make sure that we use the prevention resources that are available now through the Minnesota Homeownership Center and get constituents, any constituents you have, that information to them so that they have the resources available to them now to address their individual situations.
Thank you for that. And are there any other questions? Any members? Comments? Well, thank you for your service, and we wish you well. And when's your actual departure date? When's the last day I can call you for a little more follow-up?
My last day will be October 31st.
Okay. Well, you might still get a couple calls then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay. Let's go to Minnesota's Department of Employment and Economic Development. Next, please. Mr. Coleman's coming forward, and please, Mr. Erickson as well.
I can't read it. Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Terry Coleman. I'm officially not a deed employee. I'm a employee of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority.
We welcome you.
Deed is one of six state agencies that make up the PFA, or Public Facilities Authority. We are a municipal bond bank. And my board also authorized me to enter into an interagency agreement with Deed, where I actually manage the community finance unit, so the brownfields, contaminated site redevelopment program, as well as the small community development block grant program, which is the HUD CDBG for non-entitlement communities, as well as the business infrastructure development program, provides infrastructure. If I can make a few comments real broadly about that division, the community development division, most of the stuff we do concentrates on smaller rural communities, but not 100%. We do try to look at the needs of communities and make judgments of where funds and investments, whether they be in housing, public facilities, or the total downtown revitalization efforts, based on need and impact that the projects being proposed will help eliminate those needs. Just about everything we do is multi-agency coordinated. Reed spends probably as much time working with housing and finance agency folks determining where the housing dollars is the best target, because this is a grant program, and 15% of the allocation for the small community block grant program is set aside strictly for housing. We, a few years back, we were allowed to do multifamily rather than just single family, so we do a combination of both now. 15% gets set aside for public facilities, 15% gets set aside for economic development projects. That is rolled into DEED, Minnesota Investment Fund, to supplement some of the state money that revolves in that account. And then 55% is set aside for comprehensive grants, which is basically revitalization of a neighborhood. We're going to redo the infrastructure, redo the housing, downtown revitalization, mixed use, whether it's infrastructure, housing, as well as maybe commercial revitalization. So take more of a comprehensive approach in working with small communities. Funding for that program 25 years ago or 26 years ago averaged around $24 to $26 million a year, and that was a phenomenal amount of money and do a lot of good, a lot of housing rehab, a lot of downtown revitalization. Today's allocation is right around $17 million, give or take a few hundred thousand dollars based on appropriations on the annual year. The value of that money is not much. We provide about the same amount of money per house that gets rehabbed today as we did back in 1984 and 1985. The difference is where we used to come in with 100% grant and fix up homes by ourselves, we now are pretty much the gap funders. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency programs, to a large extent, can provide the low-interest loans, qualify people for the mortgage, and when there's that gap, that's where you see most of the CDBG money that we administer. And that is coordinated at the local level. Again, we try to concentrate in neighborhoods and communities at one time. I think we've extended it to more of a regional concept, so you have those individuals that specialize in that type of activity know they can get funding year after year, because it is a labor-intensive aspect to deal with housing rehab and low and moderate income homeowners get their homes set. So we do work. And one other thing I'd like to say, and I'd be, I really need to say, because when I was a DEED employee, I served on the housing, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency board on behalf of the commissioner, primarily because of my background in municipal bond market. And there isn't a better housing finance agency in the state of in the U.S. They are top-notch. Their bond rating is the highest of any housing finance agency in the country without any insurance or any other kind of credit backing behind it. And the staff I found to be phenomenal, dedicated as the board. So I was very happy to serve on the board when I was there. We used to share Attorney General staff when Jim Dinerstein was alive and working for many, many years. Phenomenal relationship there, and we currently contract with one of the staff to help us out with our legal documents and legal issues related to the municipal bond market, because he has phenomenal expertise. So we do a lot of interagency cooperation. But I just want to put it in a plug. The state is losing a phenomenal commissioner in Tim Marks. So it was a pleasure working with him. I'll stand for any questions you want. I know I can talk very little about the legislation that's passed, because it doesn't really affect the programs that I supervise. You know, credit markets obviously are a huge concern with us. We've seen a lot of states, not just housing finance agencies, but state GOs, general obligation bonds being pulled from the market because right now people aren't certain where's the best place to put a few dollars they do have. So they're sitting on a lot of cash, causing a liquidity issue in the country. I'm fortunate I don't need to sell bonds until January, February, because we have enough funds to finish off this construction season. But if the credit market continues to get pinched like it has been the last few weeks or even last couple months, it could be tough going for construction next year. So water, sewer, which is what I mostly deal in.
Did you have some comments?
I have no comments. I think Terry covered it pretty well, Madam Chairman.
Okay, well, then I have a question. One of the reasons we want to deed here is you do have some housing money,
yes,
and you deal mostly with GAP. But the other thing you do is job training. And one of the things I'm really interested in this whole effort to go forward with, you know, housing, rescuing the housing situation out there, is we're going to be fixing up housing, hopefully. Some of the foreclosed properties will either be demolished, and some of it will be repaired, and some will be fixed up. And there's jobs there. And I'm curious, and I don't know if you're in a position, Mr. Coleman, to help us understand this, or if we need someone from another part of that agency, but, you know, there was just a brief mention, I think, by the commissioner about the whole area of green, you know, greening these houses, trying to make them energy efficient and so on. So some of the jobs that your agency is responsible for helping us create, that BEAT is responsible for helping us create, seems to me there's so much latitude in this recent bailout bill. I'm curious if our agencies, such as BEAT, are going after some of the job training money for the communities that need it, for the folks that are so impacted. And if you can begin to answer that today, or at least take the question back to the commissioner and others,
sure,
who can help us.
Take the question back to the commissioner. I know they've been looking in several areas in job training. With beyond me, it's just something haven't been paying any attention to. I know when it comes to rehabbing homes, I think the figure is something like 5,000 unemployed people in the construction trade that are primarily in the housing area. So the skills and ability are there definitely if the market can pick up. A lot of those were specialized in new construction, but the skill level, tools, equipment, all that can be used in revitalization of existing homes as well. So the labor pool is there. We'd love to get them to work. It's a tight market right now.
Well, let me just say the labor pool is there, but the labor pool leaves out a lot of the people who communities that are most impacted, and I'd just like to put that on your radar.
Yes.
I mean, there's some issues of economic justice here to think about. People who need training in order to participate in the recovery and be part of the rehabbing, and especially you know, in terms of the community, the impacted community criteria that's put into the law, that's put into the, it seems to me a very flexible part of what's being proposed to this, you know, to our person who's in charge at the federal level. It's got all this leeway that's been talked about earlier, then it seems to me we at least be raising this issue about job training that really helps impacted neighborhoods and the people who need those jobs in those neighborhoods to fix their own homes and make them energy efficient. So I just want to raise that and ask you to take it back. Madora?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking in particular at transportation. When you just talked about the idea of us building and doing some job training with that, of course we passed this transportation bill and we're looking at about 40,000 new jobs with that, which is terrific for you guys. But what I'm wondering is have you looked into opportunities for us to capture some of this housing money as our metro area counties are building regional transitways? And is there any opportunity at all that we might be able to run in and capture some of that opportunity to rehab housing along those corridors and then also at the same time be looking at job training and that sort of thing, supporting that? So have you, I know you haven't had a lot of time, you just got the notice and we can have, but I would encourage you to look at our transportation funding bill as well. We have a lot of big projects, a lot of rehab work along those regional transitways that will be developed by the five county joint powers agreement. So,
Madam Chair, make it real comment. One of my commissioners is on my board, Commissioner of Transportation, so I also serve on their strategic planning committee. Also, last session, legislation was passed creating a transit corridor program, no money appropriated for it, but it's the very concept of making transit areas where they stop along that corridor, space friendly, consumer orientated, multi purpose, a place where people want to get off and get on. Maybe concentrated housing efforts and things like that. So the legislation is there. We understand the intent of opportunities come up, obviously. It's something that gets discussed at the coordinating level and on housing projects with new construction and rehab. All those issues get plugged in.
Thank you. Representative Holt. It's just more the issue of, it just seems like a real important time for all the agencies to sit with each other and make sure that you're brainstorming and you're reaching out for those opportunities. And that's all that I would like to encourage. If we have to have our plans done by December 1st, which is what we just heard, let's be sure that we take advantage of this now so that 6 months from now we don't come back and say, I wish we had known about that project. So thank you, though.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to the impact of foreclosure on our renters. And I believe Matt Eichenwald from Home Money. There you are. Welcome to the committee. Just go ahead and take a seat. We're running a little short on time, so feel free to speak up. And I'm wondering if Melissa Mandersides from the Foreclosure Partners Council wants to come back up. And I think you might have had some final comments. I believe we had you down again to us here. So if the two of you could go forward, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here to talk about the impact foreclosure has on tenants. Really, this is where the foreclosure crisis affects Main Street. In Minnesota, about a quarter of our housing units are rental housing. And a foreclosure, really what it does is it strikes panic in the heart of a tenant. Oftentimes, the first a tenant will know about a foreclosure is when a sheriff's deputy shows up at the door with papers saying, this house is in foreclosure, you're going to have to move. Many tenants don't know how long they can stay. They're worried they might have to move in a week by the time the sheriff's bail. The reality of it is that they have between 6 and 8 months before they absolutely need to leave their home. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing that we try to do is just let tenants know you don't have to get out right away. One way this impacts tenants, moving is a pain. There are a lot of bills that are associated with moving. The cost of finding a new place, packing up your belongings, all those sorts of things negatively impact tenants. We've seen the call volume increase about these foreclosure calls. 2-3 years ago, it was rare that we would see a foreclosure call. Now, foreclosure calls make up about 10% of our call volume. So this is really, it's really taken us by surprise how much this affects. And really it affects, it doesn't just affect the down and out, the lowest of the low people on the socioeconomic ladder. The average caller pays about $1,100 in rent per month, which is well above the average rent in Minnesota. So it affects people who are on the track to be homeowners. And then they're hit with this, their plans are derailed. So that's really one thing that's important to highlight. It's hard to find numbers for how many tenants exactly are impacted. Estimates range about 40 to 43% in Ramsey and Hennepin County, our tenants. Less so in the outlying metro counties and less so still in greater Minnesota. But about 20% of our calls do come from greater Minnesota. The rest come from the 7-county metro area. And that's really what we're seeing at HomeLine.
Thank you. Could I just ask you a question? If a person is a renter and being told they need to leave immediately, what do you recommend the first step they take in terms of exerting the right to have you sit anywhere from 6 to 8 months?
Yeah, it depends on where they are in the foreclosure process. If this is before the sheriff's sale, I advise them to call your landlord. And if it's the landlord telling you to leave, make sure the landlord knows that they can continue to charge rent to the tenant during the redemption period. That's a 6-month period before the tenant needs to move. And that's 6 months where the landlord can still make money off this property. So really it's in both parties' interest to have the tenant stay there at the property. If it's later on in the redemption period, at the end of the redemption period, the bank does need to give the tenant 2 months notice before filing an eviction against the tenant. So I'll advise them of that, that they can stay longer there. But really it depends on where they are in the redemption period.
And basically they could call your agency to get that kind of advice. And do you want to just give your contact number for those of us, those who may be listening and not have the cable system that we have?
No problem. Our hotline number is 1-800-866-5767.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Representative Medora.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My question is, if they're early into this and they're not, they should never stop paying their rent, though. Is that correct? Because that will affect their credit leaving this facility?
Yeah, exactly. As long as they're living there, they still have a duty to pay the rent. That's upsetting to a lot of tenants. Why do I have to pay my rent when my landlord's not paying his mortgage? But you do need to pay rent. You can still have an eviction filed against you.
And I believe they passed legislation in the last session that allowed the utility bills to be paid as well by the renter so that the utilities are not cut off.
Yep, that's terrific.
And,
good bill.
Okay. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ms. Mandeside, welcome.
Thank you. Again, my name is Melissa Mandeside, and I coordinate the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council, and I'm here on behalf of that group today. In a nutshell, I do have two handouts that were distributed just a few moments ago, but just to be real brief, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Partners Council, it's basically a coordinated effort to identify, fund, and implement statewide policies and programs to effectively address the foreclosure crisis and how it affects families and communities and neighborhoods. There are numerous folks who are on the council, and I actually emailed this document that we have that summarizes it to the committee administrator, and she's indicated that she'll make it available.
Okay.
We're in the process of updating it to reflect more recent information, but the March 08 version is available online and in other locations. But basically, partners who are involved in the group range from all different sectors and basically work to coordinate their response to the crisis. The work of the Partners Council is in three areas: pre-purchase, pre-foreclosure, and post-foreclosure. With regard to pre-foreclosure, the bulk of the efforts have been related to counseling. We know that counseling is by far and away the more cost-effective approach to addressing foreclosure. An exciting statistic was recently released by Minnesota Homeownership Center, and that is that from their July and August counts, they served 2,200 households, and they were able to prevent foreclosure in 70% of the situations that they counseled. That's an amazingly high percentage, and actually up about 20% from their average, which is a little above 50%. They're not exactly sure they're working to determine what that increase may be attributed to. I think at a minimum we should celebrate that success, and then I know that Minnesota Homeownership Center is working to see if it's possible to continue to have that effective rate. As Commissioner Marks indicated earlier, the capacity of the counselors has dramatically increased from 18 to over 70 employees that are assisting homeowners that contact their organizations. Minnesota Homeownership Center is also working with the renter programs that were discussed earlier, and they're also doing dramatic outreach throughout the state. They're doing teletown halls where people can call in and get live assistance and also listen in so that they can avoid having to physically be at a location and have their face associated in any way with a crisis. They're also partnering with libraries and other communities and have these workshops all over the state. They have great resources available not only for households in distress but also for professionals that are answering calls from homeowners who have concerns. All of these resources are available on their website, which is hocmn.org. I'll say that again, hocmn.org, and I strongly encourage you to check out that site.
Excuse me, can I just ask you, do you have a telephone number as well for them?
I do on my handheld. Not at the top of my head, but I can get it.
Okay, that would be good. I think it's, again, for apparently this is being televised, it'd be good for folks who are watching to actually have that number in hand before we leave here today.
Sure, no problem. The other thing I wanted to make sure that I mentioned has to do with post-foreclosure, and that is the economic recovery of our state. What are we going to do after, you know, what do we do with all these foreclosures, with all these vacant and foreclosed homes? With that, I distributed two documents. One of them is the draft foreclosure recovery effort, and this is something that the partners have been working on for months now. And this is a summary of that effort. Basically, there are three strategies moving forward, and those are on the third and fourth pages. The first strategy is to prevent an additional 10,000 foreclosures. The second strategy is to reactivate the private investment in home and make more home purchases available for folks. As we've talked about, the credit markets are certainly tightening up. We have a goal of a first round of over nearly 3,000 mortgages. And the third strategy is to acquire and rehab 4,500 properties. I don't want to get into, because of the time, I'm not going to get into a lot of detail, but all of this is spelled out on the handout that I provided. And we are seeking feedback on this plan. You can provide feedback in a variety of ways. Probably the easiest way is on the final page of the document. There is a website. We have an online discussion board that we have been directing folks to. It's minrecovery.ning.com. Again, that's mnrecoveryplan.ning.com. And folks can make comments on this, and we strongly encourage people's feedback. The whole hope is to create a framework that will reactivate the private market to become re-engaged and assist the other sectors, the private, the nonprofit, and the foundation community, and the nonprofits and the public sector to all get together and coordinate our response to addressing the post-foreclosure situation we have in Minnesota. And then the final thing I wanted to talk about was this amazing resource that's available. We have the black and white copy provided to you, but the actual version is in color. We have worked with the with a variety of different data collectors, and there was even some legislation last year that just data collection. And what has been the hardest thing to get a handle on is what's to come. We know what's happened. We know that a certain number of foreclosures are likely to occur, but you know, where are they going to occur? Where is the highest likelihood? What can be done to reach out to those homeowners and help them prepare themselves to prevent the foreclosure, or if they're already in a foreclosure situation, to address it in the most efficient manner and, you know, potentially maybe prevent it in the long run or allow them to redeem or whatnot, the various options available. But figuring out who those homeowners are in the whole state is just extremely challenging. So we worked with the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, and we're a pilot community to begin this national effort of making this data available. And it's a bit of the data that I referred to earlier, but there's this amazing resource now that's on the website of the New York Fed. And what you can do is type in a zip code, and it accesses this database that captures about 70% of the loans that have been made, and it captures in particular the subprime and the Alt-A loans, and you can map it. You can map a variety of different things that are very, very relevant. REOs, ARMs, the share of current loans, the share of 90-day delinquents, the share of foreclosure. The mapping is just really quite amazing, and it gets down to the zip code. So you can tell, based on the county, you can see the whole state, and you can go down to the county, you can even go down to the zip code. So again, that information is available on the website that's listed here, and I encourage you to check out that and to do some mapping to find out where the communities that that you're working with are, how they're affected, and what sorts of resources might be helpful to them moving forward. And with that, I think I'll just answer any questions. Any questions?
Comments? Ms. Medeiros.
Thank you very much. I'm going to definitely check out this zip code finder here in my community. I'm very distressed by the amount of doors that I knock on, and I have somebody in what used to be considered a very wealthy area of the state in the midst of foreclosure. But I just have a question, too, regarding the rent. This was the second part of my renter's question there.
not only are you supposed to keep paying rent, but what is the obligation of the landlord to upkeep the property while this is going through? So especially now as we're going into a heating system, somebody's heat doesn't work. Is there an, does the renter have any recourse at all to be able to require that upkeep?
Both parties have the same obligation as they had under the lease. If the landlord has the obligation to keep the property in the fit for the use intended, normal wear and tear, ordinary wear and tear, all of that. If it's the landlord's responsibility to pay heat, it's still his responsibility. If the heating unit breaks, it's still the landlord's responsibility to demand that, that be prepared.
Thank you. Is there a hotline or something for the renters to call if, in fact, they're in the midst of this and, you know, basically you're sitting there with no heat?
Yeah.
You can't afford to move out because it's exactly what you talked about earlier.
Yeah, that number I gave is our toll-free hotline.
And that...
Yeah, they can call and get free advice.
1-800-866-5767.
5767, yep.
Okay. So that's where we should send them to.
Yep,
okay.
Send them over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think Ms. Benjamin might have a phone number for me.
Yes, Madam Chair. The phone number for the Minnesota Homeownership Center, and homeowners as well as professionals can contact the Homeownership Center at this number. It's 651-659-9336. 651-659-9336.
Thank you. And I'm hoping that anybody who might be observing or sharing will make use of either one of those two resources, because there's a lot of people we know out there in pain right now, both homeowners and renters. I did want to ask you a question on your framework here. The buying of 4,500 properties to assist communities in distress, I can think of several communities, one that I represent, that really needs this kind of help. You say here that Minnesota has the need to create a quasi-public agency that can receive and dispose of the properties. Is this something that requires legislation? What are we talking about here? Is this a... it doesn't exist right now, apparently.
Madam Chair, there some of the things that have been discussed are potentially creating a land bank or a land trust.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think it's important to point out is that Minneapolis and St. Paul are a pilot community for the National Community Stabilization Trust, which is acting as a national point of negotiation to receive properties in bulk from lenders. And we're looking at potentially creating something akin to that for statewide efforts to do this. One of the things that's challenging is just to get a handle on these properties as soon as they're available. Working with the realtors that are representing the REO is very challenging and time-consuming. Clearing up the title issues is equally challenging. And so there has been discussion about whether or not it makes sense to create an entity that would receive these properties and then make them available in a much more cost-effective and efficient way to CDCs, to investors, to land banks, and that sort of thing. We're unsure exactly what that's going to look like. It's potentially going to require legislation, but it's just not clear at this point.
I'd be very interested in what you go forward with that. I want to just mention one thing. I know in my neighborhood, and forward with that, I want to just mention one thing. I know in my neighborhood, and I know in some places on the north side where housing is being foreclosed, one of the big problems is people going in, ripping out the copper wiring, actually making it really extremely expensive for someone to try to take that property back and make a home out of it again. One of the laws we passed a few years ago, I happen to be the author, but I just want to remind property owners and whatever agencies might be responsible, we allowed, and I don't believe it was just limited to the city of Minneapolis, we allowed agencies who do the boarding to notify the landlords that, and the landlords themselves or the property owners, if it turns out to be a bank, and it's, you know, in the case of foreclosure, do have the right to put an alarm system in that property. And from what I can tell, very seldom is that done, or otherwise there'd be alarms going off all over some of our neighborhoods. So you know, going in and taking out the copper wiring and all that is happening. So I'm not sure how many people are aware of that as a law, and I'd probably need to check to see if it's a statewide law. I do know that it's certainly available in our city, and it's very seldom used. And that's just a feature that I would hope could be used more. Are you familiar with that? Are people talking about that in this whole process?
And so, yes, we have raised this. I've been raising that for that particular opportunity for over a year now. To various lenders and REO agents and whatnot. And their response to me has been, we can install the security system, but all it takes to make our efforts entirely futile is to just cut off the electricity coming into the house. And folks that have used the installation of security systems as a waste prevention technique in other cities have found it to not be as successful as they hoped due to the ability to turn it off so easily.
Well, I think, you know, there's quite a grapevine out there about what houses are alarmed and what houses aren't, and I think if there started to be some, you know, cases where at least there would be some protection for those houses, it's a strategy that shouldn't be abandoned without being tried. And I just want to mention it because I know I've talked with property owners who had no idea that they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Anybody in the audience want to give this committee some advice? If not, we're going to adjourn now, and let me just say that we'll be coming back again, I think, as we know a little bit more about this federal bill. We need to know. I just want to certainly leave the word with the agencies. We really hope that the flexibility that's in that federal law will be taken to heart, and that we will actually get some real help for some of our communities out of that bailout bill. So without any further comments, the meeting is adjourned.